Well, it's been 10 years since the start of Easy Equities, and what a journey. Financial results just out today. And, they don't just release financial results. They release the annual report at the same time, which is very impressive. We'll talk to Charles Savage, the CEO and founder of the Purple Group, which owns 70% of Easy Equities. Charles, I like that idea where you don't just release financials for the 12 months and then wait another 3 months for the annual report, but actually put it all together. But it does, having once been in the position of where you're sitting, it does put a lot of stress onto the auditors, the team, and everybody else to put it together in a relatively short period.
Yeah, it does. And yeah, we were supposed to release yesterday and we didn't. And it does, it creates extraordinary pressure. But, you know, the benefit of doing it is you get to tell the story rather than just the numbers. And especially in the case of our business, I think the story highlights the numbers better than just putting the numbers out there. And that's simply because I just think that the economic model of the business is evolving and needs to be better understood. Whereas if you know publishing, let's say Investec numbers have been around for 30 years, people understand it, and so the story isn't as important. But yeah, congrats to my team on pulling it off, and even though it's a day late, I think it was worth the wait.
And if you could have your life over, maybe you would have bumped out your year end to September, so you could have celebrated 1 million active clients. I see that that you do make mention of that, just under 1 million to the end of August, but actually you've passed that big mark now.
Yeah, you know, the momentum that you see in these financial results has continued into our first quarter. And, you know, I do wish our results period wasn't now. I think it's a terrible time to release your business results. Everyone's kind of got one foot in Clayton-Bird Vale, wherever they're going. And you also lose a very productive quarter, you know, so because your team are sitting doing, you know, the work to get the results out. But yeah, we've gone past 1 million clients 10 years later. You know, that seems like a long time, but it's a huge milestone for us. Gone past 60 billion in assets. And yeah, there's some big numbers now that have stacked up over 10 years. And when you reflect on them, we could never have predicted them, you know, right from the start. Having got you, it seems easy looking back, but, I can tell by the amount of hair I've got today versus 10 years ago, it hasn't always been that easy.
But if we just unpack the headline, really, as far as investors are concerned, when we spoke a year ago, you were reporting a loss. You explained why. The market didn't really believe you. They pushed your share price down to, I think it was in the 60s, and it's now 1 rand. So it's almost doubled since your low point of the past year. But that turnaround where you see the revenues growing, and the expenses still being kept kept intact or kept low. Just talk us through that and exactly on an operational side, what came together this year, and indeed, is it now going forward going to be a situation where profits will grow?
You know, Alec, I've got to rewind 3 years to say, you know, the business was born in a bull market. And so the economic cycle, the first 7 years of its life, it was in a very strong economic cycle. And really the tailwinds for us are low interest rates and, you know, and improving asset prices. And 3 years ago, that all changed. 21st November, you know, 2021, we saw the first interest rate hike. And then we subsequently saw interest rates, you know, more than triple in some markets. And that inflationary pressure meant that investors' retail wallets were under extraordinary amounts of pressure. And so for the first time, we got to see what the behavior of investors would be like when their wallets are under, you know, inflationary pressures. And what we got to, in reviewing the results that occurred in that period, we realized that in these periods, we need to be much more frugal with our spending. We need to focus on creating efficiencies in our income statement. And we also needed to improve the income generation of the group. We couldn't just rely on transactional revenue. We needed to get a better share of annuity-based revenue. And so it's taken us 3 years to apply those lessons in the group. The signs were there last year. We talked about it on the show to say, look, we've improved the business model. We've, you know, created efficiencies. Our cost to serve has come down repeatedly into this. So this year is the first time it's up, but very moderately, as you know, just up over 1% in a high inflation environment with like 10%. But at the same time, I talked about how we were shifting the income statement and creating a different annuity base. And in the result, this set of results, which I guess if you'd watched us, your show in February when you chatted to me about our half year results were in March when we covered it, you could have predicted a result that looked something like this. But I think we've exceeded all expectations and delivered a result that's even stronger than, well, much stronger than the ones we showed or highlighted in February.
How much of a bull market company are you? And I say this, and I mean, I've got to just pull this out, Charles, because it's on my desk and it's here every day. This is a gift from Easy Equities, from Charles Savage. I don't know how many years ago, but some years ago. And I have this on my desk to show that the bull is on top. So don't get waylaid. But of course, in other times when the bear is on top like this, you better be applying your mind to being in a bull market, in a bear market. But how much is your company driven by exciting times for equities or other assets?
Look, you know, I think any financial services business benefits from a low inflationary environment where consumers have got more capital. In fact, you know, and just think about any retail business, because if you think about where we sit on someone's income statement, it's after you've paid for everything else. You then put money aside for your investing activity. So there's no doubt that we will benefit more in bull market conditions. Having said that, you know, over the last 10 years, we've introduced products and services that have diversified the income statement, given us annuity regardless of market conditions, and created a sustainable business model that will survive any market conditions. And this year is testament to that. You know, we had one interest rate cut in the year. Actually, I'm just trying to think, when was the first cut? September. So it was outside our financial year. We had no interest rate cuts in this financial set of results. And yet we've showed a very healthy profit. And so there is no excuse for profits anymore. We've built a much more resilient business that is capable and will deliver sustainable profits in all market conditions, but it will thrive when economic tailwinds are behind it. And essentially, if you want to summarize that, you know, when retail consumers have got more in their wallets to spend on investing activities, we're going to do better.
And retail meaning the individuals. But at the bottom line, it's 100 million rand turnaround. In anyone's language, that's big numbers. From roughly 50 million rand loss in the previous year to a 50 million rand profit pre-tax in the year under review. So there's got to be some real practical kind of hard issues here. I know within the BizNews community on the WhatsApp channels, every now and then somebody whines about having to pay you an admin fee, which they didn't have to previously, etc.
Yeah, I mean, we introduced Thrive, which is what you're talking about, is our loyalty program. And we introduced it in October. I think the first payment run was only in December. So it's only in the income statement for 9 months. But Thrive has got two primary benefits. The first is that it's fundamentally designed to drive and engage investor behavior and create, if you like, positive investor behavior. And for those that demonstrate evidence that positive behavior, they don't pay the fee. And in fact, they get benefits way beyond the fee. So they get free brokerage and a plethora of other services that are added on to people who thrive. For those that don't demonstrate the evidence that behavior, and specifically, if you just want to pick on one thing you need to do, all you have to do is have 1 rand of inflows onto the platform, literally 1 rand. It doesn't need to be, you know, anything more than that. And if you do that, you avoid the fee. But if you don't avoid the fee, you pay 25 rand for us to safeguard your assets, keep your assets, you know, safeguard them and keep them in custody and keep the platform and all those kind of things. Now, when we think about that, we think that's a fair value exchange between us and our consumers. And, you know, a year later, or almost a year later, we can look at what the data is telling us. Firstly, is that good investors have become better investors. And what I mean by that is prior to introducing Thrive, they used to pitch up 6 times a year. So they deposited, you know, once every second month. Today, they're pitching up every month. So by putting Thrive front and center, good behaviors are actually behaving even better. And you can see that in our deposit rates. Our deposits are up from last year, about over 20% up. That's not because customers have got more money in their wallets. They haven't. You know, they've got less money this year than they had last year. So by putting the business front of mind through the loyalty program, we've increased the number of deposits and the number of depositors from good investors. That's the primary benefit. The secondary benefit, which I can't put an economic value on, but I'll give you an example and then we could, you know, talk about what the value might be. But part of Thrive, you can avoid these fees by doing educational courses on our platform. So you can increase your financial literacy. We did one course in April around crypto. And you know, crypto, as you know, is a red hot topic right now again. In one day, we served 5,500 educational courses to our community. Now, the exponential impact of that kind of education over the next decade is going to create better investors. And fundamentally, that means they're going to behave better and they're going to, you know, and get better results from their investments. So the secondary impact, you know, is we're driving education, increasing financial literacy, and that is going to pay our customers well over their, you know, investment life. And then the third economic impact, which is the one you kind of highlighted, is that the Thrive fee obviously generated revenue for us. You know, for customers that didn't pitch up and deposit, they had to pay. And the overwhelming feedback there was, and this was verbatim what customers said to me. They said, you know, Charles, I log into your platform 10 times a day to review my assets. You look after my assets all around the world. So UK, Europe, South Africa, you allow me access to listed and unlisted unit trusts and ETFs and everything in between. You're constantly investing in innovation and improving the services. We launched Easy AI this year and a whole lot of other things. And for that, you charge me 25 rand. The next thing that came out of his mouth was, and I pitch up to my bank 5 days a month. They offer me a very small suite of services that are 100% domiciled in South Africa. And for that luxury, they charge me 150 rand a month. I'm very happy with that value exchange. I think you guys are doing a great job at delivering value to your investment community. So Thrive delivered a lot of revenue. You can see it. It's in the non-activity-based revenue stream, which is highlighting our financial results, which are up 67%, or around that now, 67%. And so it was a big factor in our results set, but so was crypto, so was Rise, our institutional asset management and administration platform, Easy Equities, institutional and retail numbers were up. And it really doesn't matter where you look across the group, everything showed really resilient and good growth. And, you know, so Thrive is a lot of attention and focus was put on it because it was our first endeavor into charging, if you like, a platform fee, what we call a loyalty fee. All of our competitors do. It's still, you know, radically cheaper than any of our competitors. But another interesting kind of highlight that came out of Thrive is the industry suddenly wanted to talk about fees. And you can't talk about fees and only talk about Easy Equities fees. You have to then talk about all of our competitor fees. And an interesting data point, which I think I highlighted in the March discussion, is when people started to focus on fees and suddenly all of our competitors are stacked up next to us for the first time, and we've never done that. We've never competed on a fee base. It became very obvious that we remain cheaper than anyone else and we offered more services than anyone else in South Africa. And as a result of that, prior to implementing Thrive, for every one customer we won from a competing broker, we would lose one to a competing broker. So it was a zero-sum game. Today, for every customer we lose to a competitor, we gain 4. And so as a result of this fee debate, we've actually accelerated our conversion of customers from old world stockbrokers to, you know, Easy Equities. So Thrive has had economic benefits that, one, stack up in the income statement very obviously through income, but two, stack up in the competitor forces that are bringing customers to us faster, but also in our clients, kind of on our clients' balance sheet through their education and activities that they're performing, which are going to compound over time and turn them into better investors.
You mentioned competitors, and I guess the one thing that might hold people back from Easy Equities is the conversion rates. Now, if I just think about Shift, and we run Shift portfolios, they're part of Standard Bank. They say they've got a huge balance sheet, and their rates when you do conversions are far, far cheaper than big banks are. You know, the banks really work you over when you take money from rands to dollars or vice versa. On your side, is that something as well, if you were to do a breakdown of how well you compete? Do you compete well there, as even though you don't have a foreign exchange banking license?
Yeah, I haven't done the comparison other than with Shift. I mean, Shift is definitely cheaper than us. You know, they are part of Standard Bank, and that, you know, they're we just can't compete with them. We're not a bank. We don't have the same access. And so, you know, probably find that Standard Bank's made the strategic decision to say that's going to be a loss leader. You know, if they move money with us, they're going to spend money elsewhere in the ecosystem. So, for example, if you use a Shift card, you get, you know, pay transaction fees. We don't have that. But our fees, when we stack them up against the banks, are considerably cheaper than your traditional banks for moving money. And I'm not saying all of them, but in a large part, much cheaper. We have recognized and we have negotiated for better fees. Our banking partner is Citibank, and we're about to launch. We were hoping we'd launch it still last year, but we haven't managed to do it. But we're going to launch a more real-time service, which will come at a lower rate and might bring us much closer to Shift in terms of that competitiveness. And so we do recognize that, you know, we want to, how, if you think what our task is every year, is to remove friction from investors. And so for us, friction equals, if you want to trade US shares, an expensive exchange rate. I don't believe ours is expensive, but is there room for improvement? Yes, there is. What are we doing about it? We'll launch a new FX service in the coming weeks that makes it even cheaper. And, you know, until we are a bank, which I don't have any strategy to be one, we will, you know, banks will always be able to be a sharper edge to their sword than it is ours. Having said that, you can use that bank to move money and then use Easy Equities. You don't have to use us to move your money.
But why would you use someone like Citibank when there are players like you in the Forex markets, Revolut, Wise, and other newcomers who charge a fraction of what a traditional bank charges for foreign exchange transactions? And I'm spending time here because it is one of those massive friction points where big banks still make a huge amount of money at the cost of their customers.
Yeah, none of those you can use as a South African business. So, you know, exchange control prevents you from using for Wise, Revolut, or any of the others. You know, exchange control creates friction for the banks. And that friction means fees. That's as simple as it is. You know, they have to report every single transaction. That reporting takes time and effort and technology. And so you're never going to get a fee until exchange control is obliterated. You're never going to get a fee that equals what Revolut or what Wise charge their customers, because they're operating in free markets where there's no regulatory boundaries between those, you know, that currency exchange. And so by having exchange control, we've got to expect that we're going to pay more than those services. And why Citibank? I mean, probably top three FX bank in the world. They give us access to great technology so that we can access all of their services through APIs and not, you know, not traditional, you know, telephone broked. And then importantly, they allow us to plumb our money wherever it needs to go. And, you know, the fact that we have European shares, UK shares, Australian shares, South African shares, Kenyan shares coming soon, we need a bank that has the ability to move money wherever our customers want to invest. And so we need a global player like Citibank. It has the balance sheet and the technology to service us well, and we're very grateful for the partnership.
Wow, that's interesting. So there's a hidden cost to exchange control. Many people say, oh, exchange control doesn't really apply anymore in South Africa, certainly as an individual. But in reality, these are issues where we are falling behind the world. Maybe like on technology with Starlink. Not having Starlink means there's protection for the cell phone companies, and they can charge more for bandwidth, as we well know, being in that industry. Charles, an interesting point here as well is that your Easy Crypto, and let's move on to that area. There's lots of interest in it at the moment, red hot, as you mentioned earlier. In your ownership of Easy Crypto, you have roughly half of it that comes from Purple Group, but only the other half from Easy Equities itself. Was there any resistance from Easy Equities, remembering that Easy Equities has got a 30% shareholder in Sanlam? So it would seem to have been a smarter or a better seamless deal for Easy Equities to hold 100% of your crypto operation, which, of course, with hindsight now, I'm sure Sanlam would be saying, damn it, why have we missed out?
Yeah, I mean, you've summarized exactly what kind of occurred. You know, we had the right to buy the business from the founders, Michael Jordan and Earl Loxton. We exercised that right. When I say we, Easy Equities exercised that right. And Sanlam had the right to veto the additional purchase. So you know, Easy Equities owned 50% of the time, and we had the right to buy the other 50%. And given the fact that they'd vetoed that right, given their interests and their alignment at Easy Equities, Purple then took up the right to buy the balance. And so, as you've noted, there's this disproportionate shareholding where Purple owns more of the business as a result than Easy. Well, owns the same amount as Easy Equities, but Purple fundamentally owns more than Sanlam. You know, you've also highlighted it's natural now and easy with hindsight. So, well, it should just be sitting under Easy Equities. Yes, it should. At some point, it needs to move. Is there an urgency to move it? No, it doesn't really make a difference right now. You know, it's all part of the same group, carries the same brand. But certainly in time, that asset, it's already a very meaningful part of what we do. And over time, I can only see that growing and it making a more meaningful contribution, which means we'll have to sort out the shareholding structure and alignment with the rest of the Easy Group at some point.
It is an extraordinary run that we've seen with crypto. I did some numbers yesterday where I pulled from Kevin Ling's last 5 years. And had you invested in the S&P 500, $100 5 years ago, you'd be sitting with about $230. Had you put that into crypto or into Bitcoin, let's not say crypto, Bitcoin, you'd be sitting with nearly $2,500. So it's 10x'd the performance of the best of the rest, if you like. So it really, and that's over 5 years. It's not just a 1 year thing. It does appear that this story is now finally starting to gain traction amongst doubters. Why was it, or where was it in your own evolution of or understanding financial markets that you saw crypto, in particular Bitcoin, before others did?
Look, there are two things that really interest me about crypto. The first is the technology that underpins it. I can't be convinced that the blockchain is not a better technology base for asset ownership for the future of all assets, not just money. You know, we've seen it being used as a better currency or technology than notes, and that's proving, you know, itself now. But I see all asset ownership, the future of all asset ownership, I see it being moved to the blockchain. And so I was interested in it because of technology is first and foremost. Secondly, I was interested in because the application of the technology, the theme was it's a better store of value, it's a better form of exchange, it's a better currency than paper-based money. And that just seemed so obvious to me that, you know, that the barriers, the digital world was going to demand a much more fluid, a much more technically driven currency than what we were all used to. It wasn't about Bitcoin. It wasn't that I had a view on Bitcoin. It was just that I could see the future of money look different. And that blockchain represented that future. And so for me, it was just obvious that as a young digital business that is trying to disrupt sectors, you need to make sure you take some bets on disruptive technologies as well as other things that you need to do. But you know, that was why we did it. I think the third catalyst for it was we found great partners. You know, there were lots of crypto businesses, but we found great partners in Michael Jordan and Earl Loxton, who fundamentally believed and wanted to align themselves with what we were doing. And so it became a kind of easy and natural fit to bring those two businesses together. And you know, I can't remember now when we did the first, I think it was 2021 we did the deal. So it's been around probably 3 or 4 years. So, you know, we weren't first movers in this space, but I'm trying to think of another listed company in South Africa that has any crypto in it. And, you know, if you look at our income statement today, at least 10% of our revenue is driven directly from crypto. So, you know, if you want exposure, we certainly know MicroStrategy. It's not like we're buying Bitcoin and putting it on our balance sheet. But if you want exposure to crypto in the listed space, then I believe we're the only company in South Africa that has such a meaningful part of their business being crypto. So I'm very excited about the future. I think the institutional adoption, which started with the ETFs beginning of this year, will be reflected on as the tipping point for certainly cryptocurrencies, but I think also the tipping point for blockchain and the crypto industry at large. And we're starting to see what that might look like in the current round. And, you know, whilst it's been a fantastic asset, it hasn't been without its volatility. So it's a tough thing to hold, which is why I love our product so much, which is the EC10, which is, you know, about 60% Bitcoin and then 40% made up of 9 other coins based on market cap. It just dampens the volatility a little to have more coins in that stack, and also ensures that if there are any other emerging coins, that you get to own them. So, you know, crypto is 10% of my portfolio now, thankfully, thanks to Easy Crypto and my holdings in Purple Group. And I think that's about right. I think, you know, I think South Africans should hold about 10% of their portfolio in crypto assets, diversified crypto assets.
Well, that's an interesting point, because in our shift portfolio, we had 2% in crypto, and decided that was before you had all these crypto ETFs, and we decided to go with MicroStrategy and the only Bitcoin ETF that was there. MicroStrategy, as you've just mentioned, has been a ridiculous outperformer, and we now have 10% of our portfolio in crypto, and we'll stay with that 10%. I guess once you're there, it does seem like a feels like a good number, but who knows where that could go to. 110,000 active clients on Easy Crypto. And I'm extrapolating, because it, again, at the August year end, you're at 108,939. So you've presumably gone above that. It didn't grow by much in the year to August, but presumably there have been a lot more people now who are coming onto that bandwagon.
Yeah, you know, Easy Crypto, the technology base wasn't built by us. So when we bought the business, it was integrated in a very rudimentary way. So if you were a customer of Easy Equities, there was quite a lot of friction to get onto Easy Crypto. In August, we launched Platform 3.0. And Platform 3.0 creates a common operating platform for all of our products and services so that you could access them with much less friction, almost no friction. And that's been a game changer. You know, I don't have the exact numbers, but I'll give you an indication. You know, prior to Platform 3.0, about 100 people were finding Easy Crypto a day through the Easy Equities ecosystem. That is more than 5-6x. So now there are 500-600 people pitching up every day. So I expect, well, I've seen that Easy Crypto is growing much faster now than it was just as early as, you know, as little back as August. And the integration of our products and the combination of these products is getting much better. The user experience of consuming these products is getting much better. And Thrive is also demonstrably tying those things together by giving you better rates if you use better rewards, if you use all of the products. So, yeah, you're right. Easy Crypto didn't grow a lot by customers. I mean, it was a tough year for crypto. The first half was pretty tough. Second half, we saw some asset growth. You know, most of the growth came out of asset appreciation. And, you know, you can take that asset appreciation to year end and then look at the crypto prices from 31st of August today, and prices have almost doubled again. So the Easy Crypto business is continuing to grow at a, you know, at an exponential rate. It's one of the kind of shining stars in the group.
You've mentioned Thrive a number of times, your rewards program. If you had just come to South Africa and you didn't know anything about these, you might be tempted to say, but this looks very similar to what Discovery are doing, one of your partners. Did you learn much from them?
You know, why, if you're the best loyalty platform in the world is next door to you, happens to be a partner of ours who we, you know, respect greatly, why wouldn't you steal with your eyes a little bit of their IP? And, you know, behavioral banking is their mantra, and we'd like to steal some behavioral investing from them. But 100%. I mean, you know, I'm a massive advocate for Discovery Bank. I think it is the future of product banking. I'm a very proud customer of theirs, and I've seen how it shaped my own behavior around life insurance banking services, and how the combination of me using those services gives me more value back. And so, yeah, 100%. We've, you know, stolen some strategies from them and testing them on our customer base with great results. And you can certainly expect that we're going to do more things, and they're going to feel a lot more like Discovery in terms of vitality in the years ahead.
Might that be a potential deal for you guys into the future? You do think similarly. Discovery is always looking for new opportunities. They haven't really cracked the investment side on the retail market. They've certainly done it through brokers and that. But you do, and they have a huge customer base as well. Or does the smart partnership that you have now suit your model better?
You know, Alec, I think we're a natural fit for any bank. And I think that democratization means that you have to be multi-backed as a business. You know, we're great partners with Capitec and with Discovery. And so we're multi-banked, if you like. But if you fundamentally look at Easy Equities and what its customers are trying to achieve, then, you know, I do believe we make a very good fit with a bank. But I think partnership is the best way to get there. You know, it means that we can access multiple channels of distribution without being exclusively tied to one. And that means that we can reach more South Africans and deliver on our purpose, which is to ensure that we, you know, democratize this access point. So, you know, it's difficult at times to navigate all of these different partnerships and make sure that we don't upset one over the other. But frankly, the reason we haven't is because they're just such great partners. They're very different things that we do with Discovery versus what we do with Capitec. And it's because they both focus on their market segment and they know exactly what their customers' wants and desires and needs are. And so they tailor our service to meet those needs. And so whilst I don't think we need to partner every bank in South Africa, I think that being respectful of the partnerships we've got and working with them to deliver more value to their customers and more value into their strategy year on year will mean that we just become better partners. And, you know, who knows where that might lead.
You do have a strategic shareholder. Do you partner much with Sanlam outside of Satrix?
Yeah, I mean, Sanlam have been an incredible partner to us. I mean, you know, firstly, you've got to go back a long way. Satrix was our first partner and, you know, is a huge contributor to our income state. And we work so well with the team and we're so respectful of that relationship. Secondly, when we needed to raise 100 million, Sanlam put it in. And that, you know, that was 7-8 years ago now. And without that 100 million, we wouldn't be, you know, wouldn't be talking to each other today. That was the capital that gave us, you know, fulfilled our ambitions. And then in addition to that, we've built products and services with them. So we were the first to enable access to ETFs through a LISP. And we did that with Glacier first, Sanlam's LISP. And we've done that with all the other LISPs now so that they can access ETFs and active ETFs in the future. That was a Sanlam partnership. We've also built a life insurance product with it. And that's Easy Protect, which version 2 has just gone live. And it's going to radically disrupt, in my view, life insurance for investors. So it's a niche product built for investors that fundamentally will deliver much more value to someone who invests through their life insurance. And then finally, we also built our credit product in partnership with Sanlam. So they're the balance sheet behind Easy Credit. And so, whilst they don't get the headlines on our growth story, they've been incredible partners, you know, for 10 years now, right from the start and still, you know, every year and every week. And then, you know, finally, their fintech division, which is set up by Rion. Rion and I meet regularly. We, you know, share each other our strategy, see where there's alignment and try and work together on things. So, yeah, they're great partners to our ambitions and have been for 10 years. And they've been, you know, handsomely rewarded too. You know, their 100 million investment certainly isn't worth 100 million anymore. You know, it's probably 5, 6, 7x what it was, what they've put in. And so I think there's a mutual respect and a strong relationship that, you know, will be forged into the future.
It is interesting to see how the different mindsets of the various financial institutions in South Africa have evolved. Sanlam was always into this partnership idea right from Johan van Zyl's period, and clearly it's worked out incredibly well as far as you guys are concerned. Internationally, you did have great hopes for the Philippines. You are moving into Kenya, as you mentioned earlier today, and you have a business in Australia. How's that all developing?
Yeah, Alex, slower than I'd like. I mean, it's frustrating. It's kind of the headline it has to sell under is the pace at which we're capable of entering these markets. You know, with hindsight, we should have expected the regulatory framework to move slower. You know, because we operate and live in an emerging market and a very effective emerging market. You know, South African capital markets and regulation can't be labeled third world. Our expectations of what we were going to find in these places is just haven't been delivered on. So it's been frustrating and slow. Having said that, we've created very meaningful partnerships in those regions. specifically in the Philippines. And so our right to build the business in that region in partnership is retained. We just don't have the license to deliver on that partnership just yet. There is progress with all of them. Kenya, we're literally at the hands of the CMA. We're waiting for their regulatory approval. We expect it very soon, which is cool. It's not a market that's going to light up our income statement, but it's something, it's a bit like starting Easy Equities 10 years ago in South Africa. It's a journey we need to go down, and it's a great place to start the next chapter, if you like, of Easy Equities Africa. And then in the Philippines, we've been invited into the regulatory sandbox to test our products and services in a live environment. We're hoping that that regulatory sandbox is ready for us in the first or second quarter next year. And then once we're in it, we don't know how long we'll be in it, but it'll be a live test environment where we engage with real-world customers and the regulator gets to observe these behaviors in real time. So we're hoping that that all happens next year, but I don't want to make any promises. I mean, I've been accused of making promises too soon before, and I think rightly, you know, my optimism, which I think you have to have as an entrepreneur and a CEO, hasn't delivered in terms of the timeframes. But our right to do business, we're winning it slowly. We forge great partnerships, and at some point we will go live. My only hope is that while I'm still CEO of the group, that we get to go live in the Philippines. Australia is different. You know, Australia, we've built a profitable business, a small but profitable business, roughly 15 or 16,000 customers in that region. It's a highly competitive environment and your marketing money doesn't pay. And we've seen a lot of other competitors almost disappear now in tough times. So there's been a consolidation in the industry and there are much less players. And our strategy there is the following. Continue to focus our resource on building a better product and platform in South Africa. At some point, that'll mean we've got a better platform and product set than the competitors in Australia. And at that point, we'll go and market there. So, you know, we're retaining 80 to 90% of our focus is here at home. You know, this year's results shows what we can deliver still here in South Africa. And that, in our income statement, whilst very impressive to us, I mean, 400 million of revenue in 10 years, you know, basically 90% of this revenue is Easy Equity. So 360 million. Of revenue created in 10 years. That's just the start. You know, it really is. And the South African context, we've stolen a very small part of the investment landscape from our competitors. The next decade is about, you know, turning that 400 million into 4 billion. And what's interesting about that, the journey from, you know, 1 to 400 is much longer than the journey from 400 to 4 billion. You know, and so for us, we've got to make sure we don't let our excitement of new regions, of competing on a global stage, distract us from the core focus is that there's a 4 billion input round income statement to be built here at home over the next decade. Let's get that right.
Indeed. Before we go on to where you're going to in the future, I was intrigued to see that your deposits into Easy Equities have been growing to new records every month since February. Just explain why that reflects on the health of the business. Because you said the health of the business is reflected in the deposits, but I didn't quite get that. Can you unpack it?
Yeah, you know, a deposit turns into revenue. You know, if somebody arrives, puts money into the platform, they've got to do something with that money. So they typically transact, buy a unit trust, buy shares, move money to another jurisdiction, and then buy shares. So and deposits is, if you like, it's the front door to our business. And the more deposits you make, obviously, the higher your NAV and the higher the revenue. So it's our core attack weapon. And the reason it's so impressive is that, and I really think this is the most impressive number in our results, is that we turned this theme around. If you look at all previous years since interest rates were announced, so all of our subsequent years from 2021, deposits and number of depositors were down year on year. And that was an influence of interest rates, less money. We implemented Thrive for the first time in December. By February, Thrive had turned this deposit base around. And not only turned it around, it went on to set consecutive records every single month for that month looking back 10 years. So it's the biggest February deposit base we've ever had for 10 years. The same for March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, and I can say November now. November, with 4 days still to go, November is the biggest November ever. Now, that in an environment where interest rates have unlocked, know that. So, you know, this is not because interest rates have come down by 50 basis points. That's only been a very small influence now, right at the end. You have to give credit to the business and the strategy of the business around focusing on converting customers into active depositors. And it is the health of the business. You know, if I look at our competitive landscape, and I don't want to name them because I think that's unfair, but then if you look at the headlines, or if you like the highlights or the lowlights for them is deposits. They say that, in fact, and redemption, so withdrawals are bigger than deposits. They're getting beaten up by their retail customers. We're singing a different tune. Also, our competitors are using the economic conditions as the excuse for that result, i.e., you know, the high interest rates means our customers need access to their capital, and so they're withdrawing. We're not singing the same tune. We could have, if we didn't implement Thrive, we could have said, you know, excuses or results and had the excuses. We decided to see if we could do something about it, and we've turned it around. And that's why I really do think that it's the most positive indicator of the health of our system. You know, capital inflow is it's a trust factor. The more money you attract from your customers, the more they trust you. And so we've increased our trust factor. We've also gone and fought for money that wasn't necessarily there. So it's come from somewhere else in your income statement because interest rates haven't gone down. And I think the thing that people really need to give some consideration to is we've done that at the end of the interest rate cycle. And it's always toughest in the end of the cycle because people have been under pressure, increasing pressure. Now, as we enter, as the cycle turns and as interest rates go down, with this clear focus on our customers and their deposits, what could we achieve in the years ahead as interest rates go down and and the strategies that we deploy? So I'm exceptionally excited about what we've produced, but I couldn't be more excited about what I see in front of us. You know, I see economic tailwinds, not headwinds. We've had headwinds for the largest part of these financial results. In fact, the entire part of this financial results, but you don't see us looking for excuses. And, you know, I sit here today with the luxury of having our first quarter behind us and two interest rate cuts. And I'm going, the world looks better going forward. You know, there's economic tailwinds. Trump, like him, hate him, dislike him, have no opinion on him, whatever it might be, he's good for crypto. That's good for us. He's also good for markets. That's also good for us. And those are two things that we didn't have a year ago. You know, there was no declining interest rates. There was no sight of them yet. There was no Trump. And then the third one, which there is an optimism around South Africa that I felt for the first time at your conference this year. And that optimism is translated in this coalition government. And the coalition government is translated into the highest optimism I've ever seen in South Africa. And I'm old enough to have, you know, been around in 94. I cannot tell you how optimistic I am about South Africa's future today versus where I was just 12 months ago, where I was just 6 months ago. And that optimism is another factor that is outside of our control, but it's good for South African businesses. It's good for South African equity markets. It's good for capital flows. That means it's good for Purple Group. So, you know, sitting here, we've got a whole lot of macro tailwinds that were headwinds last year that have turned in our favor. And despite not having them last year, we've produced a really good set of results. Well, I look forward to next year's results. I want to celebrate these first, but I really am already looking forward to next year's results.
Well, having one quarter behind you does certainly give you that informed position. But it is interesting, the financial results that came out recently from 91 showed that they had an outflow of 100 billion rand, Coronation an outflow of 50 billion rand. So clearly, the legacy asset management organizations are under pressure. There's no doubt. And they write it off, as you say, to all kinds of different things. But looking forward for Easy Equities, and I like doing this with you, Charles, because I know you read a lot, you think a lot. Are you like a Robin Hood of South Africa? Is it going to be that kind of business that will be spreading your tentacles and going into areas that at the moment nobody thinks you could enter? But is that where your dreams are taking you?
You know, it's interesting, Alec. I think, again, in our interviews we've done, and we've done so many, I've fought the title of being the Robin Hood of Africa. You know, many have given it to us. I'm less skeptical of that title now, because actually, if you look over the last 12 months, Robin Hood are starting to move towards us in terms of their strategy. I mean, very recently, they added 401ks, and so they've got retirement and investing money. And they've just, in fact, 2-3 weeks ago, they bought an advisory technology business. So they're going to enter the advisory space. And so they're moving towards us. If you like, we're both moving towards the middle. And the middle being the platform that enables all of the products and services that customers need on their journey to wealth creation, rather than taking a position that is, it's about trading, or it's about asset management only, or it's about unit trust. It's about actually enabling what your customers want, where they want it, at the point of in their financial journey that they demand it. And so I think the two businesses are becoming much more similar and deploying the same strategy. And so, you know, to talk about what that means for us in a decade ahead, that's different from the last decade. So, you know, anyone who's followed the story knows what we do. What are we going to be doing in the decade ahead that is significantly different from what we did in the last decade? The first and most powerful one, in our view, in terms of the strategies that we set up, is we're going to be partnering advisors. So we've kept the platform a place for people who want to manage their money for themselves. So there's no ability for advisors to partner the platform and bring their customers along for the journey. We've shifted our thinking there. And the reason we've shifted that thinking is that over the last decade, we've built a platform that is capable of servicing all of our customers' wealth needs, which means it's capable of servicing advisors' clients' needs too. And advisors, very significant and large advisors, independent advisors, have approached us and shared this insight. You know, they're competing with advisors that are tied to large brands and who make significant investment in platforms on behalf of their advisors. And yet the independents aren't making those investments. So they don't have access to platforms and capabilities and products like we've got. And so they've approached us to say, can we partner with you? Will you upgrade your services so that we can onboard customers into your platform? And will you also unlock your distribution if we bring you assets? So if we bring you assets and customers, will you bring us assets or give us access to assets and customers? And the answer to that is yes. You know, we have got a evolving customer base. Some of them been with us a decade. Some of them still 12 years old. Others in their late 90s with differing needs. Some of those needs, they want advice. And so in the next decade, we want to unlock advice on the platform where advisors can join us, bring their customers, and we will unlock distribution to them, as well as technology. You know, we've invested heavily. I'm not going to remember the number, but it must be close to $400 million we've invested in our technology stack. We're not asking them to pay for that. We're saying, come here, you can utilize it to better serve your customers and to acquire customers faster. So that's new. We didn't do that in the last decade. We're going to be doing that in the next decade, starting in January on the technical bill, which will probably take 12 months. You know, it's not going to be delivered in the next financial year. Second area, which we've hinted at over the last decade, is that we think the future of investing is, or future of easy equities, is not just about investing. You know, so we built a credit product, we built an insurance product, but we haven't scaled it. We've kept them in beta for almost 2 years now. The credit product, 1 year, the Easy Protect, 18 months, the life product. We've kept them in beta because we wanted to learn and we wanted to improve the products. But the next decade will be about delivering more products like that, but also putting more emphasis on scaling those products into our distribution so that we get our customers get better value out of the credit products that we offer them, but also the life products and other financial services that we want to bring to market. And the roadmap for those financial services is wide and really defined in the following way. To the extent that I can help you create wealth, I have an obligation to go and find the products and services that are able to do that and deliver them to you as a customer. The other side of that coin is, to the extent I can help you protect wealth, then I have the mandate to go and find those services. So you can think about things like wills, tax, estate planning, and a whole lot of other services that are going to fill our time and efforts over the next decade, which again augments well with the advisory pivot, i.e. changing the platform to service advisors. And then the third area that I'd like to highlight, which I think is going to be different, is that, you know, the last decade has all been around South Africa. You know, we've, I feel like we've won the Currie Cup, you know, probably 10 years in a row now. And my biggest disappointment or my biggest failure in the last decade is that we failed to even land on the World Cup stage. We haven't even played, you know, it's, and that, I take it really personally, and I think it is a personal failure that we haven't been able to deliver easy equities into another market. And over the next decade, I've got to achieve that. We need to deliver, we need to win on the world stage. You know, it's not good enough just to have a small business in Australia. It's not good enough to have a partnership with GCaps in Philippines. It's not good enough to be waiting for regulatory approval in Kenya. We need to prove that our platform capability is good enough to win on the global stage. And I'm convinced it is, but it needs more of my time and focus. And those three things are really what I think will define the next decade, but underpinned by this incredible core that we've built and distribution and platform capability that is compounding at an extraordinary rate. And you know, that those rates are evident in this income statement, and those, and as I said, that's just the start. So, you know, I'm excited about what I see in front of us. The challenges are not small, but the opportunity sets are significant. And the difference on this decade is we have the income statement to deliver on these dreams. I mean, you know, Alec, you might remember, but Easy Equities is built on a 2 million rand budget. That's the first version. You know, we're sitting on 160 million in cash. We've got an income statement that's delivering 50 million in profit. We've got a, you know, and we've got this incredible distribution, partnerships, product base. We don't have any excuses to deliver on the next decade. In fact, there's just, we've got to make the right strategic choices and make sure we don't do too much and focus on the things that are going to lift the income statement. But it's a much better position to be in than we were 10 years ago.
It's a little bit like Jim Collins' flywheel. And it appears from what we've been discussing today that Thrive, the loyalty program, has just accelerated that flywheel maybe a little more. It's a great place to end, but I've got to ask you this last question on mortgages. I see that you're going into that market. Now, that's exciting, because if you can get a guy's mortgage, that's usually their biggest asset. And if you can start entering that field, that's a massive disruptor. How are you going to do things differently, though, to the mortgages that are currently available through the legacy players?
Yeah, so we're not... You know, phase one is just to ensure that we get our customers the best possible price on their mortgages. So it's an aggregator play, because we've got this million, you know, customers. Let's aggregate their needs. Why can we do that better than someone else? We know more about you than somebody else does. So we've proven, we call it the easy score, but we've proven that our easy score is a better indicator of your credit worthiness than any other score out there. And so, what we want to do is ensure that Easy Equities customers get better rates from the banks through this channel. That's the starting point. And then to understand what they're buying and where they're buying it, so that we can then think about the products and services that we might want to deliver into that market. So as an example, you know, once we've got this active customer base that is purchasing mortgages through our channel, we know where they live, we know what the value of their homes are. We could deliver mortgages through our Easy Credit. We could deliver house insurance through Easy Protect. We could deliver a whole suite of services that are tailored around that information. So the starting point is really, you know, an aggregator play, leverage our distribution, learn something new about a market we don't understand, learn more about our customers, and then deliver new products into those insights. So we're not going to go and do mortgages. We're going to walk before we run. And just aggregate and make sure our customers get a better price on their mortgages. Because again, you know, if mortgages are the biggest investment you make, then a 1% improvement on your mortgage over a 30-year term is a significant upliftment on your investment assets, both your home and your ability to invest with us. So it's in our interest to help you get better mortgages.
So if I understand correctly, it's more of a mortgage originator at the moment than actually lending money on that side. And one would imagine that your partners at Capitec would be very excited about this, given that they've put a lot of attention now on getting into that market as a new area for them as well.
Yeah, no doubt. Our partner banks will certainly want to capture the opportunity. And since we partnered with them, they kind of got first right, if you like.
It's an exciting story, Charles. I guess your own shareholders will be saying, thank goodness the share price has gone from 60 cents to 1.10 rand. But it's a long way from the 3.50 rand that I do remember. What's your message to those guys who are happier but not delighted as they might have been a couple of years ago?
Alec, I think I've got to worry less about what the share price determines our value to be, because I don't think it's a true reflection of value. And what I have to do, though, is deliver consistently better results every time we come out and set results. So, that theme started in February. We delivered a good set of results in February. We delivered a better set of results now in November, for our August year end. And my focus is on delivering an even better set of results in February and then shifting my focus to delivering a better results for the year end. And I think if we do that consistently for the next 3 to 5 reporting periods, then the share price will deliver the value that we all expect of it. But if you worry about the share price, nothing's going to happen. So, for me, it's about action in the income statement and make sure we deliver on the results and the share price will look after itself. I think there are huge improvement areas in the current income statement. I thought our customer acquisition numbers were lower than I'd like to see. Yes, it's a tough market, but it's getting better. So that's, I would like to see us accelerate that. Two, I still think there's room to improve in our cost to serve and creating better efficiencies in our cost base. And, any efficiency we create there flows immediately to the bottom line. And then three, we've got some, the excuses have all gone from the economic conditions. We've got some tailwinds behind us. And so I think, those are going to help us accelerate our growth too. So, I think shareholders can look forward to, improving results with every period, and we're doing our best to ensure that our focus is on delivering results every 6 months and not disrupting, not getting in our own way around results. Because I think we can stand accused of that as time, is that we talk the big picture and then fail in the short term. And, hopefully February and these sets of results give our shareholders confidence that we're building a much more sustainable business with much more predictable income streams, with lots of green shoots that can surprise the market if we pull some of them off.
Over 1 million active customers, over 60 billion in assets that those customers hold, and the vast majority of them are retail individuals. Some big moves there for Easy Equities or the Purple Group, which owns 70% of it, in the year and years ahead. Charles Savage is the CEO of the Purple Group. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.